Hello, it's Anna Perrow and Sophie Little here. We run Soundyard and we are the producers of Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
We're excited to tell you we've been nominated for an award. It's a public vote, so if you'd like to vote for us, well, that would just be amazing. You can head to norfolkartsawards.org.
Look out for Soundyard. We're under the Broadcast and Media Award, and it's such a pleasure putting the show together and listening with you.
So let's join Chris and Matthew on High Ash Farm.
You're listening to Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
Well, it's always a pleasure to come to High Ash Farm and to enjoy a ride in the farm pickup truck with our pilot and guide, Chris Skinner, who's here for another podcast. Chris, the Countryside podcast, back with us, and well, we've got a fine day for it.
Yes, we're really lucky, Matthew. September's proving to be a very clement month, as often it is. The weather's ideal for farming, and we're in top gear on the farm. We're getting any hedges that need cutting. They're being trimmed at the moment, and lots of other activity as well. And the last of the hay is being delivered that's outside in stacks and all going off to different parts of the county and the country. Goodness me. And so it's just headless, I suppose you'd call it. You don't know which way to turn, because farmers always make the most of the weather before it starts to turn in October and certainly in November. But this is also the time we start some of the farming enterprises, seeding the fields for next year and also harvesting this year's root crops, things like sugar beet, which is a big crop in this county of Norfolk, and obviously the potato harvest on the very best land as well, a highly expensive crop to grow, and both of those are really commodities as well now, so it's a very competitive marketplace indeed. And soft fruit as well, still quite a lot of small holdings in the county of Norfolk and Suffolk in particular, and some of the fruit from there, the top fruit we call it, things like apples and pears, they've also become commodities, and it's almost uneconomic to pick them at the moment. And I've got a lovely orchard here at the farm with Bramley apples, and many of them just drop on the ground, but I will try and find a good home for some this year.
Well, I'm trying to drop a hint there, and maybe later.
I saw your face light up.
Nice apple pie will go down
the
tree.
But you've got to get your blackberries to go with it, because there is nothing quite like blackberry and apple pie. Anyway,
it's very much the food of the season, isn't it? But here we are on the side of a slope, isn't it, with a wooded slope. And the wind is coming through the trees.
Yes.
And why are we here?
Right. Well, we've been covering the past history of the farm. We started off a few podcasts ago with the Stone Age and the polished flint axes I found at the farm. And then the Iceni occupation of the farm. We've got an Iceni temple just on the other side of the field behind us. Then the Roman invasion in AD 40. Came to Caister, and this is the Roman capital of Eastern Britain here at High Ash Farm at Caister St Edmund. And then we've looked briefly last podcast at the Saxon era, and really from the beginning of that time around, what we'll go for about 500 AD right through to the early thousands, we have something called the Dark Ages. And it lasted 500 or 600 years. It's quite a long period where there's actually not a great deal of historical evidence. But I'm going to prove that wrong today, because we're standing on something quite amazing. Whether you know it or not, Norfolk's pretty well flat, isn't it?
Well, I mentioned the slope, and it's quite steep here,
right,
isn't it?
Right. So what we're going to do is just to go down this, because...
I've got to clamber down, have I?
Yes. Yeah, right. Just be careful.
Chris is going first.
Very steep.
Yeah, I'll try not to slide down. I'm glad it hasn't rained too much today, but this is a steep slope. We're making our way through the trees and down through the undergrowth, and oh, that wasn't too bad. I'm glad I put my four-wheel drive shoes on today.
You never quite know what you're going to be dished out when you come to High Ash Farm. Well, look at this, Matthew. In front of us is a bank, and it's obviously not natural. It's been made by humans.
Sorry, what gives us that clue then?
Right. We are at the bottom of the bank, and the top of the bank is 8 or 9 feet above us. So we've come down a 45-degree, quite sharp angle. If you put 1 foot wrong, you'd be head over heels to get to where we're standing. And the field behind us is a gentle slope carrying on up the hill. So this area of woodland gives this kind of slope its name. It's called Cantley Hill Plantation. And it's planted on the side of the hill, but really the woodland was here for shooting purposes. And you can see we've got some monumental beech trees here, all in avenues, stretching out behind us. And this area of the woodland was planted out in the sort of mid-1800s. So these trees are quite mature now and growing away. But this bank is a huge feature. It is exactly 1 furlong long, 220 yards long from this point we're standing to the other end of it. And what happened is it's created by oxen ploughing, because the style of farming had started to change just from small square fields. It gradually, as we went through that period known as the Dark Ages, the farming, all the old farming hedges were taken out, and you had a whole open field system, it was called. And so villages often had 2 fields or even 3 fields, and they would alternate what crop was growing on which field. And each of the parishioners would have a little strip of land in those furlongs. And so they would grow their own crops in there and feed their families. And the whole structure of the countryside had changed from individual farm homesteads to people living in villages. So they went out to the fields to work. Now, what happened was ploughs started to change from being pulled by 2 oxen with that yoke between them that we looked at last week, called a hornbeam, and they started to put several oxen together, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So you could have bigger machines behind them, but they were still pretty crude ploughs. And it wasn't till the end of this period, just before the Norman Conquest, that ploughing completely changed. Farmers devised something which would turn the soil over rather than riffle it. Riffle's quite an important word, because it was used by the Saxons, and it just means to gently scratch or turn very gently the soil, but it didn't invert it like a plough does. Riffle is still used today, but we call it rifle. And when you look down a rifle barrel, there's a very gentle twist in the barrel itself.
The cartridge will revolve inside the barrel.
The bullet. Yeah, very different to a shotgun. The bullet will revolve, and because it's spinning, it makes a much straighter trajectory. So that's, we still use that word riffle, but the correct use of riffle is to turn or slightly move the soil, really.
So there was no depth to riffling, but no. There was just enough maybe to sow seeds?
Yes, that's right. And so what happened once a mould board was developed, you then started to use horses, and of course that was a huge change in agriculture from oxen to horsepower, and we still use that today. You know, if you've got 100 horsepower car or a tractor, 100 horsepower, which we have several at the farm, you could see that beginning to change from the old way of farming with oxen to horsepower. So you'd need fewer horses, but you had to keep the horses stabled, and they were working horses, and they were here right until the period where I was born in the late 1940s. We had Suffolk punchers here to do, you know, really heavy horses, very powerful, very gentle, but the other thing about them was they were manoeuvrable at the end of the field, whereas oxen were, to put it politely, stubborn to get them to turn round. And so the complete change in farming happened. These long fields, open fields, were made, and the ploughing, you always ploughed towards the centre once you had a mulble. But before that, with the oxen would always turn the soil down the hill. They would riffle it and it moved gradually down the hill. And that is what caused this bank.
What, centuries of
absolutely, well, probably 1,000 years worth of soil tillage. Perhaps, a couple of centimetres a year. We're walking back up that bank now and it's all good topsoil, but it's just moved down to this particular point, to this furlong long edge of the wood, 220 yards long, and it's really good topsoil all the way down to the bottom. But it just moved because it was much easier for the oxen to slightly riffle the soil and it moved down the hill. So that's what happened. So this was one of the enclosures, if you like, although it was open at the time, for the village of Caister. And the other one we will visit a bit later on the other side of the farm. One's heavyish clay, which this one is, and the other one is light sandy soil. Light and heavy meant how difficult it was for the oxen or the horses to pull the plough through the soil. So lots and lots of change.
This is a living reminder then of a way of life that lasted 1,000 years.
Yes, exactly that. So we've come out of the end of the Saxon period, and of course we then got invaded yet again. It doesn't make me laugh. We had the Norman conquest, the Norman invasion, sort of 1066, one of the most famous periods in history, I suppose. Everybody knows that particular date.
And they came to Norwich, didn't they? The castle is evidence of that.
Yes, absolutely. And parts of Caister Church on the other side of this farm has also got some Roman... there is some Roman footings. We think Caister Church was built on perhaps a really medieval church going way back in time, at Roman times. And the church was rebuilt, some Saxon influence in there, about 600, 700 AD. And again, the Normans really sort of made it into what we today can recognise as a proper church. So there we are, a little bit of the history. And we'll move forwards in time. But first of all, I'm going to take you to a field where there's still the evidence of that new form of ploughing, which is called ridge and furrow. Just listen. Wow. I just heard a goshawk.
Okay.
There.
That's a goshawk.
That's a goshawk. One of our incredible woodland birds.
I would have said buzzard.
No, it's a much higher pitch, more drawn out, and we've got young goshawk here in the farm. And I'll let you into a secret. The wood is fantastic for goshawk because we've got deer here, and the deer, if you bop down low, you can see underneath the understory. Can you see completely? The deer have browsed it.
Yes. We've got roe deer. It's clear up to about 2 or 3 feet.
Yes, and that's the hunting zone for the goshawk, one of our scarce woodland birds. You are really lucky to. We only got a couple of shrieks. It's probably saying, "What are you doing in my territory?" We've got humans here. And so right through the woodland, you've got this understory, and that's the hunting zone. So the goshawk can fly through like a bullet. It's like a double-sized sparrow hawk, to give you an idea, a really ferocious predator. And it will take rabbits, quite easily a fully grown rabbit, quite easily squirrels and any birds that tend to get in the way, wood pigeons, anything like that. They are easy captured by the goshawk. They're deadly hunters. You are so lucky just to hear that. It's a higher pitch than a buzzard, and it's more drawn out as well, so that's the differential. So there we are,
a goshawk.
There we go. That was an added bonus.
Free of charge.
Yes, actually the proper name would be a goosehawk for them, and that's where it's derived from, because they were used for hunting geese years ago.
Back up the slope. I tell you what, Chris, I'd have loved to have seen you in charge of a team of oxen.
Yes. I have a job controlling the tractor, but I got a wonderful picture of my father with a team of 4 horses ploughing on a field near here, and he was 16 years old and had to do that after he left school before he went to New Zealand. Unbelievable.
We're on one of the back lanes on the farm with the sun coming through the trees and very, very quiet here, and squirrel running across the road. And Chris, you've got a fine collection of Himalayan balsam.
Yes, I have a lot of criticism about this plant, and it's obviously an invader. Some people call it Himalayan balsam, some people call it Indian balsam, and it was brought in by us, and it's kind of escaped. It was a kind of garden plant. It has actually a lovely perfume. It's very popular with the bees here at the farm. It's got a problem because it's part of its scientific name is Impatiens, so it's the same family. If you grow busy lizzies in your garden, same family as that, Matthew. And it's quite aromatic, and it's also called policeman's helmet since it's been here, because if we just walk down, you can see in the ditch, it spreads itself really well along watercourses, and it is a bit invasive. It's got no real known pests and predators, so these ones here are just about finished flowering, and you can see the little seed heads underneath. And one of the tricks I love to do is just I just pop the seed head,
so spring loaded,
and the seeds pop out everywhere.
Oh, do it again.
And here we go, let's see if we can find another right one here, just about there. Let's have a look. Yep, there it goes.
Oh. and the seeds get broadcast.
And so what happens is when animals like deer or we've got a nuthatch singing behind us. It's being sworn at.
This sunshine's bringing out all the birds, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just cheeping away. That's definitely a nuthatch. Sitta europinus, the plastering bird. Lovely. Anyway, that spring-loaded action is quite important. So when a fox or a deer or even a rabbit goes underneath these plants and just jars the plant a little bit, those little seed heads, spring-loaded, which you rightly said, drops the seeds out on the animal, and the seed can get distributed like that. Or the seed drops in water, and it's really gone right through our waterway systems right across the county. So it's quite popular with bees. It's a wonder we haven't got any, although this particular bit's in the shade, but the other side, and we've just got to squeeze in a bit because we're right on the edge of a road, so I can see a truck coming. So the seeds will float down into the river systems, and it's all over the county, so people are pulling it out left, right and centre, whereas in my view it's doing a really important job. It's harvesting, it's photosynthesizing and taking in carbon dioxide and releasing oxygen in parts of the farm where there's nothing really growing at this time of the year. So also, it was a former resident, which many people don't know. Right back in the Carboniferous era, we'll call it, way back millions of years, certain seams of coal right up near Driffield in Yorkshire has got Himalayan balsam in the coal seam.
So it was here originally.
It was here originally, but then we've had a few ice ages and things. And so I did mention it's not really got any predators, but sometimes you have to eat your own words, Matthew. So beside us is a Himalayan balsam, and it's a little bit different to all the others.
Oh my word, it looks like, it's completely leafless, isn't it? And almost lifeless.
There's just a few flowers on it.
So who's eaten that?
Right. Well, it's a complete surprise, because I mentioned bees are very popular, and it's also popular with moths, which I did not know. And there's one really beautiful moth. The colour of the flowers of Himalayan balsam is sort of vivid pink, I suppose, the only way to describe it. And this moth is called the elephant hawk moth. It's also got that same colour pink. This is the adult moth. So the moth comes along, it likes this plant for some reason, lays its eggs on the plant. The eggs then hatch out into a caterpillar. And as fate would have it, here,
Just under the leaf,
a hands and knees job.
That's not a caterpillar.
That is a caterpillar. That's the elephant hawk moth.
It's an elephant, yes, certainly.
It does look like an elephant. It's close.
Must be two or 3 inches long at least.
It's 4 inches long, Matthew.
Oh, yes, you've just extended it out.
And if it gets at all alarmed, the head retracts into the body so that the head actually looks like an elephant with its eye, and at the far end is a little tail piece. And it's a very delicate, beautiful moth caterpillar, almost ready to pupate.
He's in eight sections. He's a brownie green colour, more green at the front.
Yes, yeah, and you can see the head is beginning to descend into the top part of the body. There it goes, and so you've got that flat little bit that you'd have on an elephant. It's just lacking the trunk at the moment, but in a moment, a little like trunk extension will come out of the head, and you can see the big eye on the top, hence elephant hawk moth.
That's going to be a juicy meal for a bird.
Absolutely, that was, we are so lucky to see that, because there's lots of tit species along this hedge, and I mean that's more than a day's food for something like a great tit or a blue tit, something like that. So there we are, you are really spoilt to see that. There we are, Himalayan balsam. Bit of a pest, but maybe it's good for some of our moth and bee species. And if they all get defoliated like that, I don't think anybody would mind having Himalayan balsam in their area. There we are, what a surprise.
And a gigantic caterpillar, a monster.
So, had to eat my own words. There we are. No wonder I look like I do.
What am I looking for?
Matthew, there's a quarry in the middle of the field in front of us, and there's some hawthorn bushes in the quarry just with their heads sticking out, and in the centre hawthorn bush is a large bird with a white centre. Can you just see it? It looks like a plastic bag hanging in the trees, right in the middle of the pine wood behind it, and you should be able to see it. It's a buzzard, one of Hayash's young buzzards, almost pure white. And I don't think you can see it. Let me turn the engine off and I'll hold the microphone.
Let's get hold of these binoculars.
Yes, now, it's in right in the middle. There it is, just flown off.
Oh, man.
Yes, but I don't think it's gone far. I think it's just gone onto the ground. So what we'll do is drive on a little bit. It's just gone behind. There it is, just gone into the tree. Wow, beautiful, right in front of you. you spotted the elephant hawk moth caterpillar, and I can see a buzzard. It's bang in the middle of that quarry on the hawthorn bushes. So if you put the binoculars up again, I can see it really clearly. It's just staring at us. Yeah, so
yes.
Have you got it?
I think I can.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
He is looking at us. Very light coloured.
Yeah, very light coloured. And
it's
absolutely colossal.
Oh, wow.
And that, believe it or not, is a young buzzard.
Oh.
We might be able to get in a bit closer.
There he is.
Yeah. Oh, he's just dropped down.
Yeah.
Now, if he turns towards us, there, almost looks like an osprey. Which
under the wings, very white.
Almost pure white. And that's typical of buzzards, Matthew, that the colour variation, and it does confuse people, is absolutely huge. Well done. I'm so pleased you spotted them. That's a 10x pair of binoculars, so they're pretty powerful.
You've got 10x eyes, obviously, to be able
Well,
to see.
I'm tuned into them, and I have been all my life. I love birds of prey. I love all the different bird species here at Hayash. And you can see, that's a formidable bird. It's got a 4-foot wingspan already. 1,200 mil, that's 1.2 metres.
He's looking at us.
And looking at us. He can hear us and sizing us up. Right, we'll keep the microphone going because I'm going to take you back in time when buzzards probably were here in previous centuries, because this field that we're on is the second field that was farmed by all the villagers. It was open plan, no hedges whatsoever. And it was all done in furlongs. So this field is 2 furlongs long and 1 furlong wide. It's exactly 220 yards from this hedge on my right to the far hedge that we're now going up the hill. Somebody's grooming their horse. Now, a little bit of history coming through the car wheels. Just have a feel. Can you feel we're...
It's a bit bumpy.
We're going up and down, and this is the old ridge and furrow.
So this
was ploughed long ways, so you used the horses, and the ploughs turned the soil inwards each time.
I mean, it's all grass now,
so
isn't it?
So it is all grass.
But you've still got the contours.
It's still those contours of the ridge and furrow, and we've driven up quite high enough. Should be able to see the buzzard is... yes, there he is. Right, just to the left of that white horse.
Got him.
You've got him this
time.
You've got
the outline.
You've got your eye in at long last. There we are.
It's only taken 20 years.
Wow, that's incredible. And that's only 100 metres from us. And that's a stunning bird, absolutely stunning.
Here, Chris, have a look through the glasses.
And if I brought you here 10 years ago, only that short period of time, and told you we'd be looking at buzzards...
It was never on the agenda then, was
it? No, absolutely not. So it's partly the improvement in management of the countryside, partly a more enlightened view from local gamekeepers. They're still heavily, heavily persecuted, so don't get me wrong. Norfolk, sadly, has come out as a recent record as the county in UK which has the highest persecution of birds of prey. So it's not a record I jump up and down about. But gradually...
It means it's being taken seriously,
yes,
though.
Yes, oh, right. Yes, gradually things are improving. Let me just have a look, because you don't often get views like this. Oh, wow, that's absolutely stunning. A young bird, probably only 16 weeks old, and looking after itself, and really unusual and very, very noticeable, because it's almost pure white speckled breast and completely white under the wings. And there we are. So, just in the corner of the wood there, I can see a little white dot, and that is my camera. And it's very close to that bird. It seems to like those old dead hawthorn branches there. And that's its favourite sitting spot. And sometimes it will mew and make this very high-pitched call. We heard something similar with the goshawk earlier. And this call is really very, very clever, because in the wooded hillsides, which were its home in Wales and places like that, the valleys with the timbered slopes, the buzzards go up in the air and call, and that's the very best sound for travelling from one side of the valley to the other. A high-pitched, plaintive call, which you wouldn't expect to come from such a large bird. You'd think it was something quite sort of throaty and deep, but completely the opposite. It's a mew is the only way to describe it.
And he's still sitting there, bold as brass, yes. But of course... They're top of the food chain.
Top of
they?
The food chain.
Apart from us.
And they're not persecuted here whatsoever, so it feels quite safe, and it's a relationship between me and the wildlife here that's taken 2 decades at least to establish, and that's why we're seeing what we're seeing.
Wonderful sight of a young buzzard. Well, our trip to High Ash Farm for another podcast is almost drawing to a close, but it's really been very enjoyable in this lovely September weather. Just a breeze, or quite a strong breeze going on, and oh my word, Chris Skinner has just emerged from the truck with a shovel, spade.
I can see the worried look and the furrowed brow.
Because that means work.
It does to me. Yes, my father said that this is the best friend you'll ever have, Chris. He said, your spade. And he gave me a spade, and long since it's been broken several times and has worn up.
He's had 15 different handles and 12 different blades.
Yes, and several different owners as well, because it's all done with a plough these days. Anyway, Matthew, a few years back, I brought you to this field, and it was a bare, sandy slope facing southwards, drought-stricken soil. It's how the glaciers left it at the last ice age. And since then, I've sown it with a really diverse mix of wildflowers. And it's recently been cut, mown and removed, and baled up as well. And so it's had what we called a fresh start, and that was in early September. We've had some rains, the weather is warm and mild, and we have a huge amount of regrowth from one particular plant. And as you know, with my wildflower fields here at High Ash Farm, we like to provide pollen and nectar from spring through summer and into autumn. Ivy does it naturally at right the end of the season. That's in flower at the moment.
You've got some lovely ivy just behind us.
Yes, there is, and it's all flowering, and it's brilliant fodder for things like red admirals and peacocks, tortoise, small tortoiseshells, and any of the butterfly and moss species that are going to hibernate as adults. But this crop is drought resistant on this sandy soil, so it's done at second growth. We'll just walk out a little bit, because it's really special.
Bit of hedging going on, by the way, in the background.
Right in the distance, that's Neil on the farm hedger. And it's just coming into flower. And in a week's time, Matthew, this field will be deep purple colour.
Like your old rock band.
Deep purple, yes. So it's called alfalfa, or lucerne. Many people know it as a lucerne, and it's a legume. You can see legumes, they have that typical three leaves near the top, and it's in flower at the moment, and it's a P-shaped flower. And I've had lots of offers from people who've just seen the flowers coming out. Can we come and pick some of the flower heads off? And I said, of course you can. There's going to be tens of thousands of flower heads in the next few days. And so I said, why do you want that? We use them on salads. And it's gone to one particular restaurant in the middle of Norwich. Very fancy.
I hope they're giving you a free meal.
Well, I wish they would, but I'm a generous farmer. I'm just going to get you to pick that off, that flower head. Just pick it off right near the top. Pop it in your mouth. And don't say, I never give you anything. And then chew it. And you will find it is very aromatic. And very sweet and flavoursome.
That is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, in a smaller measure, very good on salads and all sorts of dishes.
It's exactly what it's being used for, but it's also colourful. So, it's a brilliant plant. It's a kind of cut and come again plant. It's already, since the 1st of September when it was mown, what's this? This is over...
Sort of knee height, isn't it?
Yeah, it is knee high. What's that, about 40 centimetres? So it's just well over a foot tall. Each plant is lush, and there's two or three tillers on each one because it was mown right down close to the ground. So, there we are.
It's slightly peppery as well, isn't it?
The flavour will gradually come, but if you put it in with quite a plain salad, it gives it, I suppose the word is piquance. I'm not sure about my French.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm not sure. Yeah. Anyway, let's just walk in a little bit more because it's really special. And I've got, let's have a look here. This is what the spade is for. So we're going to dig in and take a good lump of soil out and turn that over.
Oh, juicy worm.
Absolutely full of worms. Straight away. Another one there.
Oh, dozens of them.
Absolutely. Look, another one there.
That's a tiny clod, really, isn't it?
That's just a tiny clod. That's what they called me at school. Or was it clot? Right. Right. Now, I was going to say sandfoin. We've got sandfoin here as well, which is this plant here. Some's come up. It's got a really long taproot. This is sandfoin, one of the other drought-resistant plants.
There's almost as much of it under the ground as there is.
There is more, because I've actually accidentally snapped the root off. It goes down over 2 feet. Right. This is the scientist's challenge. It's the hot gossip topic at the moment in the scientific world. This is sandfoin. This one here has also come out as well, is clover, red clover. And this one is, I've just snapped the top of that one off. We'll see if we can find a better one. Yep, here we are. This is the alfalfa and lucerne. All three of them are legumes, same family as peas, same family as lupins in your garden. Each of these three plants hold the magic trick, because we look at the roots on the sandfoin, it goes down. Do you see what I mean? And I snapped it off. That root is 2 feet long.
It's a very long, straggly root there,
right,
isn't it?
There's something near the top. This little bulge. Can you see that?
It's like a nodule.
Exactly the right word. Well done, Gudgeon. It is a nodule. Now, look at this one that I've mown. Same plant. Can you see?
That's covered in gnarly
nodules. Absolutely
30, 40 on there.
So is that a disease?
No, completely the opposite. Well, you could actually call it a disease if you wanted to. It's a bacteria, and it has done something special. It's formed the relationship with the lucerne, the clover, and the sainfoin. It's kind of a symbiotic relationship because the fungus has this really special trick. Most of our atmosphere that we're breathing in, about 20% is oxygen. Much of the rest of it is nitrogen. And this bacteria, actually harvests the nitrogen from the atmosphere, locks it up, and the roots of the clovers here actually feed on the nitrogen. And if you look on this field, it looks as though I've been about with a fertilizer spreader. It is dark, dark green, as though it's had a heavy dose of artificial fertilizer.
It's really verdant, but that's natural nitrogen from the air.
Exactly that. And it's been fixed by this bacteria. So why are the scientists still jumping up and down with huge excitement? Because they think they're on the verge of getting those nodules that we pulled out and looked at just now to fix onto cereal plants. So cereals, they've got to do some genetic manipulation to get this to happen. So cereals...
They can fertilise themselves.
Exactly that. It's the...
That's a big bang moment.
It's the holy grail of scientific research at the moment. Well, I'm not a scientist. Now, here's your clover. Big leaves, juicy trifoliate leaves, red clover. And just look close to ground level. We just move a bit of the soil out with my little fingernail, and you will see, there they are. Look,
just little,
probably 50 of them just there.
And that's what allows the nitrogen to be fixed.
Yep, it's doing an incredible job, this bacteria. So it's just mind-blowing that if that can happen, then we reduce our reliance on artificial fertilisers on agricultural land.
Which has an impact, a good impact, on the environment.
Of course, but the whole problem of it is, you know, what effect does it have on the wildlife once you start fixing nitrogen with the crop? So is it just for human benefit, or is it going to benefit the environment? And the answer is, at the moment, because we haven't done it, it's called genetic manipulation. So we've somehow got to get legume genes into cereal plants so that the nodules are attracted to the cereal roots and fertilize it. So is that a step too far, or is it just agricultural progress for the benefit of humans? I'm not sure.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the Countryside podcast with Chris Skinner as much as I have enjoyed this visit, this very fine September day. We've had an osprey calling, we've had a nuthatch, and we've had a caterpillar the size of a good old British banger,
yes,
haven't we? And now the science bit as well. And look at all the nodules on there.
Yes, look at that. That's the alpha.
Looks like Rice Krispies.
Yes, it does. Yeah, they're closely clung together, and a little shoot coming out with a trifoliate on for the new plant to grow. It is just jam-packed with nodules. There we are.
Hundreds of thousands of these plants,
yes,
here, aren't they?
Yeah, so there we are. It's a lesson for everybody here, and great excitement. Who says farming stands still? It doesn't anymore. It's moving at rocket speed.
That's it from High Ash Farm. Chris Skinner, we'll see you for the next podcast.
You're welcome.
This is a Soundyard production. Music by Tom Harris.
Hello, it's Anna and Sophie from Soundyard here with a little note on supporting the show.
Since we launched the new podcast, we keep getting questions about how you can support the production of it. This week we've launched a donations platform. It's entirely optional. You can choose to donate as much as you like as a one-off or a monthly payment.
Head to donorbox.org/countrysidepodcast. That's donorbox.org/countrysidepodcast. There's a link for this in the show notes wherever you're listening. Your donation goes towards the production of the podcast and our CD service that we provide for people that cannot access the internet.
So if you feel you're in a position where you can support the show in this way, then thank you. Catch you next week.